to the most recent census data, one in two Americans, or 150 million people, now live in poverty. Today's guest, best-selling investigative journalist Barbara Ehrenreich, has launched a new reporting project to tell their stories and to move the crisis of poverty and economic disparities to the center of our national conversation. Her latest piece focuses on how the poor are made to pay for their poverty. She writes, before we can, quote, do something for the poor, there are some things we need to stop doing to them. So what changes need to be made to reverse these disturbing trends? What kind of poverty reporting would you like to see? And what's really missing? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. At least 90 soldiers have been killed in a suicide bombing in the Yemeni capital Sana'a during a rehearsal for a military parade. The authorities say more than 200 were injured. Sebastian Usher reports.
The explosion went off mid-morning as Yemen TV was broadcasting the military parade rehearsal live from central Sana'a. Hundreds of soldiers were then seen rushing away from where the blast happened. Dozens of bodies were shown lifeless on the ground. It's the first major attack in Sana'a since the new president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, took power in February. It's already been blamed on al-Qaeda. The army is currently staging, with US backing, a big offensive in the south against militants linked to al-Qaeda.
Hundreds of protesters have stormed the presidential palace in the Malian capital Bamako, where they're reported to have assaulted the interim president, Diankunda Traore. Hospital sources said Mr. Traore was unconscious in hospital. Unconfirmed reports say the security forces killed three people. The protesters were demonstrating their anger at a deal negotiated with the West African regional organization ECOWAS, extending Mr. Traore's caretaker role to a year. The former Sri Lankan army chief, Sarat Fonseca, has walked free after 2 years in prison in Colombo to cheers from hundreds of supporters. Mr. Fonseca led the army to victory over Tamil Tiger rebels in 2009, but he later fell out with the Sri Lankan president. From Colombo, Charles Haviland.
Sarat Fonseca has had his own prison cell for the past 2 years, but has been jailed within the same walls as ordinary criminals and Tamil Tiger suspects. Today he said goodbye for the last time and walked out, telling thousands of supporters he would go on working to save Sri Lanka and was willing to sacrifice his life to do this. He then took a triumphant tour in an open-top vehicle before joining his family at home. He is sounding defiant. The question is whether he will want to plunge fully back into politics and whether the terms of his release allow this.
The Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim is facing new criminal charges, this time in connection with his role at a big anti-government rally last month. He's accused of inciting the crowd to break through police barricades. Jennifer Pack reports.
A video circulating online shows Mr. Anwar gesturing to a senior opposition party member just seconds before the crowds pushed past the police. Government allies say this shows that the opposition leader was out to cause chaos, a charge Mr. Anwar denies. If convicted, the opposition leader could be disqualified from running in the next election. That's why Mr. Anwar's lawyer tells the BBC that the charge is politically motivated. The opposition leader is seen as the only person capable of challenging the governing party, who have been in power for more than five decades.
BBC News. President Obama has reassured Afghanistan that it will not be left on its own after NATO hands over responsibility for the country's security to Afghan forces in 2014. Speaking at the summit of NATO in Chicago, Mr. Obama said a strategic partnership deal reached with President Hamid Karzai meant agreement was possible on a long-term relationship with Afghanistan beyond 2014. Earlier, a dispute between the United States and Pakistan threatened to overshadow the second day of the summit. Caroline Wyatt reports from Chicago.
The dispute with Pakistan over reopening its borders with Afghanistan to allow NATO convoys through is far from resolved. Some 40% of NATO's non-lethal supplies used to come through that route before Pakistan closed it last November after a US airstrike killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. Though President Zardari of Pakistan was invited to the summit, he's made clear that he wants the US to stop those strikes and for NATO to pay around $5,000 a truck for its convoys. That's something NATO's unwilling to do, although using that route would make its exit from Afghanistan far easier.
Facebook's share price has dropped sharply on its second day of trading as a public company, falling well below the $38 at which the stocks were initially floated. This report from our business correspondent, Mark Gregory.
It's the largest ever share issue by a technology firm. It's the most talked about stock market event of recent times, and it's got off to a poor start. Facebook shares only stayed above the $38 offer price on Friday, thanks to repeated buying of the stock by the underwriters, the financial firms that manage the flotation. And now in the second day of trading, Facebook shares have already slumped below the launch price. It's early days yet, but it doesn't look good.
Mark Gregory reporting, BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to the most recent census data, one in two Americans, or 150 million people, are now living in poverty. The scale of poverty affecting people of color is even more severe. We've got more than 46 million Americans receiving food stamps. That's one in seven. 21 million students receive subsidized lunches. The numbers across the board continue to rise. In the year 2000, 12 million people lived in deep poverty. That number is now 20 million. And by deep poverty, we're talking about $11,000 a year for a family of four. Today's guest, best-selling investigative journalist Barbara Ehrenreich, argues that while these issues are getting national attention, most conversations focus on things like jobs programs and other types of programs for the poor, while ignoring what the poor currently face right now, namely things like wage theft. Employers are not paying the poor for all of the hours they've worked, and this amounts to $105 billion a year. But this fact is rarely mentioned. Barbara Ehrenreich has teamed up with the Institute for Policy Studies to launch the Economic Hardship Reporting Project to expose issues like wage theft and to move the crisis of poverty and economic disparities to the center of the national conversation. Barbara Ehrenreich is author of many bestsellers, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. The 10th anniversary edition was published last year. Her latest piece is called Preying on the Poor, How Government and Corporations Use the Poor as Piggy Banks. Hi, Barbara. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, Rose. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. And I should say I'm really excited because I'm joining your Economic Hardship Reporting Project to report on the stories that aren't getting much attention, and especially with these angles that you mentioned. Now, you've been reporting on this issue for many, many years. What are some of the gaps that you're seeing, and what kind of hole do you hope to fill here?
You mean with the Economic Hardship Reporting Project?
Yeah.
Well, my thought was there's a lot more reporting and journalism that needs to be done about people who are experiencing poverty and economic hardship. And secondly, that there are a lot of journalists who are themselves experiencing those things because there's been such a wipeout, in the print industry and, well, anywhere where journalists might want to publish, they're not likely to be paid anymore. So I started trying to raise money to support journalists to do innovative reporting on these sorts of issues. Journalists who, like yourself, Rose, could probably use a paying gig. Since the expectations now seems to be that writing is something that you just do for free.
Right.
To amuse yourself with.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think people realize this. I mean, right now, if you do an investigative piece with quotes and facts on the ground reporting and you pitch it to an alternative outlet, you might get maybe $200. And one outlet paid me about $150 and they said, oh, can you interview a couple more people for this? And I said, are you kidding? Do you realize you're not even paying me minimum wage? I don't think people realize that.
No, it came to me about 3 years ago when I got the New York Times to let me do a series of pieces about people who were already poor and how they were weathering the economic downturn. And they were very nice. I got four fairly large, fairly long pieces in to the New York Times. Did a lot of research, did a lot of traveling, interviewing people. And I realized that I was not going to make any money off of it.
Mm. Even with the New York Times.
My expenses would barely be paid.
And that's even at the New York Times.
That's the New York Times. That's not small or alternative.
Right.
And they just don't like to pay freelancers. So then I started thinking, you know, okay, I can do this because I have savings. Because, I can just say, all right, I'm going to take 6 months and work on this and I won't make any money. That's just, it's so important to me. I've got to do it anyway. But then why are we relying on people to be philanthropic, to do good journalism?
Right.
I thought this is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. Other people should be doing it. And I've got to help them to do it.
Well, good for you. And so what has the response been when you approach foundations and people with money and say, look, we've got to actually pay journalists who want to give the poor a voice?
Well, we have raised some money. I can say that. We're giving it away as fast as we can to journalists. So far, so good. And we're very excited to have people like you interested, Rose.
And, you know, the piece you wrote for Tom Dispatch, you really focus on the fact that, you know, right now, if you search the word poverty, there's so much reporting at the local level. And, of course, because of Occupy, the language has really changed. You're seeing a lot more stories about inequality, for example. But you point out that most of the reporting focuses on what do we need to do to create good jobs? What do we need to do to implement programs for the poor or save what's left of the social safety net? And your main argument is we need to really focus on how the poor are just being completely fleeced by both the private sector and the government. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to sort of invert the discussion. There's too much about, well, what can we do for the poor? Right. And there's not enough looking at the manufacture of poverty, the creation of poverty that's going on all around us. Now, you mentioned in your intro that wage theft. This is not something I have extensively researched, but I rely on some very good investigative reporting that's been done about it. This is so widespread. And when I saw the numbers, in the range of $100 billion a year, and this is an estimate, all right, and I would say it's probably a modest one, because how are we going to know? I mean, the wage theft is often very subtle. It can take the form of the employer deciding you're not entitled to overtime pay, even though you are, or take the form, and I've actually experienced this, of the employer telling you to get in much earlier than when the clock starts ticking for your pay. And so you just, you know, maybe have 45 minutes or an hour each day that's not paid for. Or it can take the form of just reprogramming the computers so they shave off a certain amount of dollars or hours from people's employment records and from their paychecks. Wait a minute. What are we talking about? We have big fights about government programs that cost a lot less than $100 billion a year, and this flagrant theft is going on. Then, another area, and this is thanks to my colleague at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, is in excess amounts that people pay for credit if they are low income or if they're considered bad risks for any reason. And, you know, that you're not going to have a regular credit card. You might have going to have a subprime credit card if you are considered risky. Meaning you're going to pay much more interest than an affluent person does.
Right.
So, you know, I had Gary Rivlin estimate, and he came out with about $30 billion extracted from the poor through extremely high excessive interest rates because they are poor. And he says that if you include some, you know, other things, it would be up, you know, a full estimate would be about $60 billion.
Wow. So going back to wage theft, if the estimate's about $100 billion a year, and again, you experienced this personally because for your book, Nickel and Dimed, you tried to get by on minimum wage. And so you were working every day in restaurants and stores that paid you minimum wage alongside people whose sole income comes from minimum wage. And your book got so much publicity. Gary's book, Broke USA, we had him on just a couple weeks ago. His book got a lot of publicity. Why do you think things like wage theft don't get more attention?
I'm doing my best, Rose. What can I say? it's fixed in a lot of affluent people's minds that the poor are kind of dependent. Mm-hmm. They are dependents on more affluent people. And that the whole discussion has to be about, well, can we, should we give them more or less through public sector programs? I think that that's completely wrong. We have to understand the way in which the poor, in fact, over-contribute financially and in terms of their work to the rest of society.
Right. Because that is the line that you hear, this foreclosure crisis is the homeowner's problem. The poor got in over their heads. They shouldn't have taken that loan out. Why do they go to payday lending places in the first place? It's their problem. I mean, we have to go back a couple of decades, right, to talk about how all of this started, and sort of under Reagan, this kind of going after the poor and really vilifying the poor.
Yeah. I mean, it was in the 70s, really, that the far right began to identify. Initially, it was welfare as a major target for their, to campaign to stop welfare, and kind of fixed as much as possible in people's mind a stereotype, which is racist in addition to being class prejudiced, that people who are really, really needy are lazy, promiscuous, possibly addicted, they have criminal tendencies, and so on. So that's kind of a hard thing to shake.
Right. And how do you think the progressive community has done in countering that? We had a professor on, her name escapes me, from UC Berkeley, and she said one of the problems is that liberals have a really hard time talking about the poor.
I don't know. I think the general liberal kind of conversation probably hasn't changed a lot in 40 years. Mm. How can we have more jobs that are decent-paying jobs, and do we need to strengthen the safety net in some ways? And that's about it. I mean, look, I find myself often very frustrated in certain kinds of liberal circles, trying to get across that the poor are, in fact, victims of theft.
We're speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich. She's teamed up with the Institute for Policy Studies to launch the Economic Hardship Reporting Project to expose these issues of theft, things like wage theft, and also to move the crisis of poverty and economic disparities to the center of our national conversation. Barbara is author of many bestsellers, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. And if you have a question or comment for Barbara about this reporting project and about poverty, what are your thoughts on the theft that she's talking about? How the poor are made to pay for their poverty, even when the government has discovered people who have already have little can be a profitable business. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. What sort of angles do you think are missing from the national dialogue, and what will it take to really get politicians and policymakers to really focus on things like wage theft to get this conversation really going? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And if you've read Barbara's book or her work, we'd love to hear from you. I'm sure that many of you who have read Nickel and Dimed. And have you experienced some of these issues personally? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So talk about a few of the other issues that you hope to really expose and really talk about with this new project.
Well, just to finish on the theme of, well, theft or mm-hmm. money, I should say more neutrally, money being extracted from the poor in part because they are poor. I think for me the big discovery in my recent essay that went out from Economic Hardship Reporting Project is that its government is participating in this too. Mm. I've been concerned for a long time about the criminalization of poverty. You know, the fact that if you are in financial trouble, you are much more likely to be in trouble with the law, one way or another. I mean, of the misdemeanors that are committed in this country every year, about at least 11 million, most of those are the people prosecuted are people of very limited means, people who would qualify, for example, for legal aid, if we even offered even legal aid in most courts anymore. And so I've always been impressed by sort of the level of harassment. I mean, like, if here's the sort of standard example. You're driving a car with a broken taillight. A cop pulls you over. There will be a fine. Now, you probably don't have the brake light or the taillight because you couldn't afford to fix it.
Right.
So you're going to face a fine, say $100 or $200 or something. But you can't pay that either. If you could pay that, you would have paid to have the light changed. So now you're stuck with that, and you are going to have penalties and interest piling up on that debt you now have to local government in addition to everything else. At some point, it sounds like it should be against the law, but at some point you can be jailed now for your debts. If it's a public sector debt and you just haven't paid a fine, there will, you know, eventually be a warrant out for you. And then the next time you get stopped for some minor traffic thing, it's not going to be a ticket, it's going to be an arrest and with jail. And then to make this all ever more savage, a growing number of jails, county and city jails, are charging their inmates for room and board.
Yeah.
So why are you in jail in the first place? If we just follow my scenario of a person who starts with a traffic violation or a broken light, they're in jail because they were too poor to get things fixed and to get fines paid.
I was shocked to read this in your piece. You write that Edwina Nolan, a homeless Michigan woman who was jailed in 2009 for failing to pay $104 a month to cover the room and board charges for her 16-year-old son's incarceration. When she received a back paycheck, she thought it would allow her to pay for her son's jail. Instead, it was confiscated and applied to the cost of her own incarceration.
Yes.
I mean, this is shocking.
I mean, Dickensian is not the word for this.
Yeah.
I mean, this is persecution. This is, and why does it get more attention? I don't know. And the scale, and let me just talk about the money involved here. It's very frustrating to try to find out anything about local law enforcement. Nobody centrally gathers the information. There is a study by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers that came up with the number of about 11 million people, at least in the mid-2000s, being charged with misdemeanors. Now, if each one of those misdemeanors is going to incur a fine of, let's say, really, really minimally $200, then we're talking right there about... where are we? $2 billion?
Right.
Yeah. There's no way of getting numbers on the charging for room and board, and I doubt that they can even collect that money from most people. There's just no way. But there's so many ways in which people find wherever they turn that they have to pay, or because they're poor, they haven't paid, and now they're in trouble with the law, which means only one thing, that you're going to get poorer, in addition to the possibility of being incarcerated, of course.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's hear from our listeners on this. Let's go to Jeff in Scotts Valley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
We're fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a small one, and I'll take the answer offline, but I'm noticing back in the early 70s with the anti-poverty program, a lot of the money was originally started from Washington and sent directly to anti-poverty programs that actually, you know, provided services for the poor. And then and that essentially was working, but that was changed partly because of political reasons, I'm assuming, to actually have the money go directly to the states in the form of block grants and then have that money be distributed by politicians. And I think that really changed the whole demographics of the anti-poverty program. And then later, all of that money went to the war in Vietnam, so it was all lost. But I want to know if your guest could comment on that.
All right, thank you. Barbara, have you been following
that?
Yes,
that's a very good point. I mean, that has been the Republican approach for quite a while, is to not fund programs directly, but to have block grants that go through the states. And state legislatures tend to be quite conservative, or at least very beholden to private, to business and corporations in their state.
All right. Thank you for the call, Jeff. And let's take a few more before we go to break. Let's hear from Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Barbara. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and you do great work. Thanks. My question is more sort of an observation, like culturally, you know, and the relationship between like middle class and lower class. You know, my generation, we don't really identify ourselves as working class. We're, you know, all identification or, you know, information workers. And you know, very sort of disparate. When I was growing up in Oakland as a child, you know, we were very much part of a working class family, and there were lots of them in the neighborhood, and occasionally people would fall into poverty. They'd lose their job or whatnot. So there was a sort of support and identification that moved back and forth between the two, and you just don't see that anymore.
Well, it's true, Mike. I would say, though, we saw quite a resurgence in that sense of having a, you know, a common fate and the need for solidarity among people who are struggling financially in the Occupy movement. Mm. That whole idea of the 99%, which is, of course, quite a stretch to think everybody in the 99% is in similar circumstances. But nonetheless, you know, it's just to recognize that many people, wherever they started out in life, are facing the same sorts of issues today.
And before we go to break, Barbara, what do you think of the Occupy movement and where they are today?
Well, where they are today, that's what I want to know. I want them back in our faces.
Well, they definitely were on the streets of Chicago this last week for the NATO meetings.
That's right, yeah. No, I'm waiting. I'm ready to support and participate.
We're speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, and she's teamed up with the Institute for Policy Studies to launch the Economic Hardship Reporting Project to expose issues she just brought up, everything from wage theft to paying for room and board charges for children who are incarcerated. After the break, we will talk about a few more studies, and at least a third of states being in debt can now land you in jail. Attempts to collect from the already poor, according to Barbara, can be vicious and often, one would think, self-defeating. Most states confiscate driver's licenses of people owing child support, virtually guaranteeing that they will not be able to work. Michigan just started suspending driver's licenses of people who owe money for parking tickets. So we'll be talking about more of these undercovered stories after we come back from our break. And as many of you know, Barbara is the author of many bestsellers, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. You can find her latest piece, Preying on the the Poor at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, joining Rose here in the studio in the last minutes of our May membership campaign. 90 minutes from now, we will be wrapping this campaign up. And I just really want to express my gratitude for the hundreds of listeners who have showed their support today, helping take us from $50,000 to go when we started the day to under $30,000 to go. Your support at 800-525-9917 will help keep this station strong. And I'm just so grateful, Rose, that we can have a place for this kind of conversation. There's nothing glamorous about it. You're obviously not going to get a lot of corporate sponsorships by doing shows about reporting on the poor.
Right.
But we're able to do it because we say this is important and listeners come to give it their support. Speaking of which, we have three listeners, Constance Goodyear Barron, Jacques Fitch, and Lee Ziegler, who put together a big challenge for this hour. $2,250. $2,250. And they've said if other listeners contribute twice that amount, $4,500. That $2,250 is here as well. Show your support now in this last edition of Your Call as we wrap up this membership campaign. Now the number, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org. Your call is supported by you. 100% of our funding comes from you. We could not be here without you. And as Matt said, we tackle these issues. We talk about poverty and inequality on a regular basis here. We give people a voice. We bring in members of our community who are working on the ground. We've had homeless children on this show. These are the kinds of voices you're not hearing in the national media. Sure, they're talking about inequality and poverty, but when have you heard from people who are homeless or people who for whom they're not being paid? These are the kinds of voices we bring on this show. Support that kind of independent radio. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org. And thanks to Constance, Jock, and Lee, if we can get...
We need to get $4,500 during this hour. 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. We have just a couple of hours to go. Support independent radio. Send a message. This kind of media is so crucial right now. 800-525-9917. We've had a great morning. If you can afford at the $50 level, that's great. If you can afford more, a dollar a day, you can become a Your Call insider. Come into the station, see the show. Let us know what you want to hear. 800-525-9917.
Or KALW.org, where you can see thank you gifts like the 10th anniversary edition of Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed. That's yours for a $100 contribution. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thanks to everyone who's on the line right now. Please join them. Thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up to get our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation about affordable housing. Where should affordable housing be built at a time in the Bay Area? It's booming and there's so many very pricey condos are in the works. So when we're talking about the poor and people who are not really making much more than minimum wage, barely a living wage, where's the housing for them? And where's the housing for those of us who are not making over 100 grand a year? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking with Barbara Ehrenreich, best-selling investigative journalist and author. She's the author of many books, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. She just teamed up with the Institute for Policy Studies to launch the Economic Hardship Reporting Project to expose so many of the issues we're talking about today, including things like wage theft, and to move the crisis of poverty and economic disparities to the center of our national conversation. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have a question or a comment for Barbara, if you have been at the receiving end of something like wage theft or if you know of anyone who's had to pay for incarceration, or maybe someone who lost their license, if you got a ticket for something like a brake light and you want to talk about the experience, I actually got a ticket because my tags were from last year, and you have to go down to City Hall to deal with the problem, to try to get the tags, and then you have to go in again, you have to pay for it, and then you have to get that off of your record. So if you have any questions about or comments about just what you have to go through, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Barbara, the other thing that's amazing, and you point this out in your piece, is, you know, something like in a study of 15 states, the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU found 14 states contained jurisdictions that charge a lump sum poverty penalty of up to $300 for those who cannot pay their fees and fines, plus late fees and collection fees for those who need to pay overtime. So if any jail time is imposed, that too may cost money, as the homeless woman Edwina Nolan discovered, and the cost of parole and probation are increasingly being passed along to the offender. So you're just digging out of this hole, and the fees are just continually piled up on top of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I that's why I say, you know, we used to use the term the cycle of poverty. It used to mean, you know, that if you were financially poor, you were going to be kind of psychologically demoralized, which would make it harder for you to make more money, and so you'd be poorer. That was the cycle. I say the cycle today is that because you're in poverty, you're going to get in some kind of trouble with the law much more easily than other people will, as for, you know, the broken taillight possibility, or many other things you could, the offenses you could commit. But the effect then of getting in trouble with the law is to make you poorer, which is likely to be more trouble with the law.
Right, and then if you're deemed a criminal, you report you can pretty much kiss your remaining assets goodbye.
Yes, I know. I mean, just, you know, there are so many. It's not just that it's, you know, it's two things. One is that the number of actual offenses has been increasing. I'll give you an example just because I think it's so bizarre. The New York City subway system has made it now a crime to put your feet up on a seat. So it can be 3 a.m, you're in an empty subway car, you put the feet up, your feet up on the seat across from you, you know, to perhaps, you know, get more comfortable after a long shift as a restaurant worker. And you don't just get warned by a cop, you get arrested for that.
Arrested?
Arrested. Taken to jail. Washington, D.C. Has criminalized now driving with an expired license. That used to be, you know, if you had an expired license, that would be very bad, and you'd be certainly warned and given some kind of a ticket. Now you're arrested. Mm-hmm. Now being arrested means you go, you know, you go to jail. You go to a holding tank anyway. You surrender your freedom, essentially. One woman, D.C. woman I know, was, in a sense, incarcerated for 12 hours because of a broken turn signal until, you know, it just one thing led to another. And she didn't have enough money to say, hey, let me just pay everything right now and walk out of here. Mm. You can't do that.
And did you hear about the sit lie law that passed in San Francisco last year?
The what is that?
It's the sit lie law. So you can't actually sit on a sidewalk because a lot of people complained about the increasing number of homeless people in San Francisco who were sitting and lying on the sidewalk.
So, yes, that's fairly common. Almost anything you might do while if you're homeless is illegal.
Right.
Let's just say it's illegal to be homeless. Sitting on sidewalks, that's been criminalized. That's very widespread. Lying down, God forbid you should lie down on a sidewalk or in a public place, even a park bench. You know, all of these things, of course, urinating in public, anything like that, and these are all crimes.
I noticed that in San Francisco, I'm seeing so many more homeless people on the streets. And I noticed that on the benches now, they're putting these sort of railings, like four railings on the bench. So it's just enough to hold one person, and there's no possible way you can actually sleep on it.
Clever of them, huh?
Right.
And you'll see that in private buildings, too. Wherever they come down to the sidewalk and it's public space, if there was some kind of little ledge that you could sit along, you're likely to find, things sticking out of it or something to prevent you from doing so.
Well, let's go back to calls. We still have full lines. Let's hear from Don in Belmont. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I just wanted to say that one of the reasons that they can get away with wage theft is because they know that there's 100 people in line for your job. Hmm. And that really helps them get away with it. They can do just about anything they want. Age discrimination, I'm facing that now that I'm 60. And also, I've had all the car issues happening from no registration because I couldn't pay it. Then you get pulled over. Then you get fined. And I've been in that loop. And once you get in the system, it's very, very difficult to get out of it.
Mm. Are you currently working right now, Don?
No, I'm not. I'm just moved back here from Arizona and finding there's quite a bit of jobs out there that I'm available for, but again, I'm just concerned. My expertise area is administrative office manager, and the times that I do apply, they are really, really looking for younger, perky, smiley people, even though I've got the experience and the energy to run circles around them.
Have you had many interviews? Are you getting that far?
I'm not getting any interviews. I've only been back for 2 weeks. I'm really not getting any interviews. I've sent out maybe 20, 25 resumes with great cover letters. I'm not a bad writer. Mm. And not getting any callbacks. In fact, one place that I applied for, they want you to answer a couple of questions via video.
Ah.
Send them that link, and I'm not even sure if that's legal. That looks like another form of discrimination to me.
Huh. Wow, I've never heard of that. Well, gosh, thank you so much for calling, Don, and good luck with your job search. Barbara, have you heard of these video interviews before
you
go into the office?
But that's, all people who are looking for jobs are told to conceal their age if they're over, say, even 40.
Right.
That you don't put anything in your resume or you don't give any clue, they'd have to see you physically to decide you're, quote, too old. But I did want to comment, Don's remark was very important. People can't really challenge wage theft if they are so terrified of losing their jobs and they don't, they don't want to stand out in any way.
Mm.
And you lose your job, you can have a very hard time replacing your job, and in the meantime, you could sink all the way into homelessness.
Right. Well, and even younger people. My brother's younger, and he was fired from his job, and people were rehired without any benefits and at a lower wage. So they basically told a group of people, we're just not doing well right now. The economy's bad. But then they found out just a week later they hired a brand new bunch of young people for a lower wage with no benefits.
Well, that's pretty clear cut, isn't it?
Yeah.
The
project that you're launching, it seems like this is all kind of, a lot of this is new. So the challenge here will be to find out how often this is really happening, how widespread this is. And I'm thinking it's probably fairly widespread.
Yes. But all of this does take research.
Right.
Nobody is monitoring. Well, there are groups like the Brennan Center at NYU, which has done very good work on how court costs are increasingly imposed on the indigent, the very poor, and so on. But there's just not anywhere near enough going on any of these subjects.
Well, thank you again for calling, Don. Let's go next to Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Oh, man, I love you so much. It's so good to hear your voice. I'm really glad that you have Barbara on your show this morning. I haven't really gotten a chance to read any of her books yet, but I think I have that nickel and dime one somewhere. I've seen her a couple times on Democracy Now. But, that's good that that nasty H word homelessness has come up. You know, I'm 45 years old, and I became homeless on October 8th of 2009, after having the same apartment for 21 years. You know, I've been disabled now. I became disabled in my early 30s. Mm. And, you know, I get upset when I hear some of our city council members, especially Ryan Coonerty, talking about how great the homeless services here are in Santa Cruz. Well, let me tell you what, it's been quite a struggle for me. You know, I had to sleep outside last year, you know, from the last week of August to October 1st, and I got taken in for a while. And just recently, I was staying at the Poly Loft here in Santa Cruz, and I have a doctor's note because I just got diagnosed with blood loss-induced anemia last month, and I have a doctor's note stating that, you know, that could I please be lodged for as long as possible because he's going to be running all these tests. And it's weird. They seem to have, like, their favorites there, people that seem to just are there for long periods of time to get endless extensions, but they can't honor my doctor's note. And last night was my last night at the loft. You know, I use a walker and stuff, and so I'm out, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the way they have the shelters set up here in Santa Cruz, you know, you sign up, you get 30 days. You're lucky if you get a two-week extension, and then you leave, and then you can't sign up for 30 days. And now they're making it worse, and they want to punish all of us because of the gentleman that stabbed that woman on May 7th here in Santa Cruz, and he stayed there for four nights at the shelter. And because of that, they want to crack down more. And like Barbara said, you know, it is. It's a crime. You can't sit anywhere.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for cutting. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have full lines, and you bring up some really good points here. Barbara, the homeless are also seeing major changes. In San Francisco, I'm working on a story about elderly homeless women and what they're facing. And what I'm finding is that the shelters are so bogged down that a lot of these women have nowhere to go. In some cases, they're riding the bus all night, or they're going to an overnight coffee shop, or they're going to a shelter and they're basically sleeping in chairs because there aren't enough beds.
Mm. Well, this is shocking. And I'm really, you know, what Christine said about you can stay for 30 days, but the next 30 days you cannot stay in the shelter.
Right.
And this is certainly one of the most liberal places in the country.
Exactly.
Santa Cruz, right?
Right.
Well, what kind of life is that? I mean, what are they thinking?
Yeah, and in many cases, these places are so bogged down. I mean, I'm hearing people are just getting completely lost in the system because the demand is so high and the safety net is unraveling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about people with disabilities, 77 people with disabilities were arrested in D.C. last month, a lot of them in wheelchairs. They were going there to protest the proposed $800 billion reduction in Medicaid funding. And ADAPT put this this protest on. You have people from all over the country going to D.C., Now, usually when they're arrested, the courts allow lawyers who get arrested to negotiate, maybe pay a fine or community service. But this was unprecedented. The attorney is requiring all of these activists to go back to D.C. or face arrest. And so we're talking about people mostly in wheelchairs paying about $1,000 to go back to D.C.
Well,
and this is the first time this has ever happened.
That's stunning. But, Rose, it's part of another whole phenomenon, which I'm not an expert on, but is the criminalization of protest.
Right.
I mean, I think you could spend whole shows on that. I would love to hear it. But protest is another, increasingly a crime. You can't do it in any way that, or you're very likely to end up in big trouble with the law.
Right. Even if you're a person with a disability in a wheelchair saying, don't cut my Medicaid. Well, we're definitely going to follow this because this is unprecedented. It's never happened before. And we'll talk about media coverage of this and the protests in Chicago at the NATO meetings on Friday. And let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Christine in Hayward. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I'm really interested in this program because you're talking about the fines that are given to people and how they're criminalized. I had the experience that of getting impoverished and as a new mother wanting to go to school. And I was awarded a scholarship because of my work experience and because of my undergraduate work. However, when they looked at my driving record, they saw I had parking tickets that I did pay, but my license was previously suspended. Although, and even though I corrected the situation, they thought that it was a demarcation of bad moral character, and they made it really clear, and they rescinded the scholarship from me. So even wanting to go back to school to, you know, get out of the cycle of poverty, there's so much that's punitive towards individuals, especially mothers, where it's really hard to balance everything. So that was a pretty difficult experience, and I feel for those who have fewer opportunities, but it was, it's pretty devastating.
And also, Christine, it takes so much time just to clear this stuff from your record and just deal with the basics of it, right? Stand in long lines.
There's a simple way. You can't just go online and pay the fee. You have to you have to get to the courthouse at 6 a.m. and wait in line, and you speak to the judge, negotiate, and it's pretty complicated. And if I'm not a single mother, but if I were, that would be almost impossible.
So. Well, thank you so much, Christine, for sharing your story. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
And we have just about 6 minutes left with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed, and talking about the new project, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. So if you have a comment or a question you'd like to get in, we have just one open line. We can try to get you on 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We have an email, Barbara, from Roberta, who says, the weekly or monthly assessment of U.S. economics improvement is based on consumers buying on credit. Isn't that exactly how many people become poor, and those who are already poor are indirectly told to be patriotic by buying on credit? Isn't this part of the problem?
Yes, I think that's a good point. It certainly is. And one of the things that has happened since the economic downturn is it seems like bill collecting has gotten much more aggressive,
right,
and much tougher. And this is another way in which people can get in trouble with the law. You may owe money to a landlord or a hospital or your credit card company, and at some point they decide to issue a court summons for you to come in and explain why you haven't paid. Only the court summons doesn't reach you because your address has changed or because maybe it was never sent out by the bill collector. Then once you don't show up, once you fail to appear, as they say, the warrant goes out for your arrest.
Roberta also says, by the way, Barbara, after seeing you at the Brava in the Mission years ago, I raised wages of the woman who cleans my house, so now it's $25 an hour. Thank you for the new view that I gained.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you for emailing us, Roberta. And let's hear next from Carissa in San Francisco. Hi, Carissa.
It's actually Marissa. Hey, Barbara, how are you?
Hi.
You know, my question is really about where do you think the power of influence is going to derive from? Is it going to be something that comes about because of policy changes, or are we talking about like a movement that helps promulgate change to look at the, disparity between, the haves and the have-nots?
Well, yes, I think it's a movement, and it's not a movement that, it's not something that will be solved. Perhaps over very quickly, but we have had in the case of Occupy and that movement, we have had an example of people coming together to confront gross economic inequity, and I think we have to carry it on.
Right, and it seems as though with the fines being leveraged, it's cyclical poverty, right? Because there's no way to get out of it, and so I guess I'm an attorney, so you always kind of look at policy reform. Is this something where, the people of the different states and the communities need to work together to try to address, these fines essentially being, put on to this population that doesn't allow them or enable them to actually get outside of, whatever economic challenges they're facing?
That's right. I think one of the things we can be doing is investigating conditions in our own localities, our own cities, our counties, and find out what kinds of nuisance laws or nuisance offenses people are being tormented for and what the fines are and how to stop that predation on the poor.
Right, because there's this like systemic movement of throwing people in jail, but of course all of our jails are overcrowded. So, you know, you're looking at, is this really, you know, is this really reform, right? Are we really part of rehabilitation, or are we just essentially exacerbating a very critical situation?
Well, thank you for calling, Marissa. And Barbara, we have just a minute left. So final thoughts from you on this issue and final thoughts about the project and where you want it to go.
Well, I've certainly learned some things on this show. You know, it's been very interesting and distressing to hear from people who are caught in these situations themselves, you know, cut off from things like a college a scholarship because of some unpaid parking tickets way in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is condemning people for life. And we have to all get a lot more angry about it.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for joining us. And we'll obviously be following the reporting project. I'll be writing a piece for you soon. And
great.
Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Barbara Ehrenreich has teamed up with the Institute for Policy Studies to launch the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. You can find a link to their new site at yourcallradio.org. She's also author of the best-selling book Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. The 10th anniversary edition was just published. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for your emails and phone calls, and thanks for listening.